Kia ora and welcome to Goodfellow Podcasts. This episode is kindly supported by the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners, the Auckland faculty. I'm Dr. Louise Kugler, and today I welcome to the podcast Dr. Michael Drain to discuss commercial pilots' medicals and clearance to fly. Michael is a medical officer at Air New Zealand. He has practiced as a general practitioner in the United Kingdom, the Wairarapa, and Queensland. His areas of interest include regulatory medicine and crew alertness management. Air New Zealand has a long-established aviation and occupational health unit, and COVID-19, of course, has placed new operational demands on its medical team. Michael, in his previous roles, has worked for the New Zealand Civil Aviation Authority, Emirates Airline, and the Australian Aviation Regulator, the Civil Aviation Safety Authority. Kia ora, Michael, and welcome to the podcast.
Kia ora.
It's lovely to have you here today. So today we're discussing commercial pilots' medicals, providing an update on what is required, and we'll be discussing clearance to fly, thinking about the vacationing pilot and the pilot with hazardous social behaviours. So, Michael, discussing commercial pilots now, what kind of licences do they hold and what do we need to know about?
Sure. Now, look, thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. I think many of us in practice have got some pilots, and again, I remember thinking, I know nothing about this. I wish I did to know what I'm supposed to do or what I'm not supposed to do. We're talking today about commercial pilots, and these are pilots who are working for hire and reward. There are two types of commercial license. One is the commercial pilot's license, and the other is called the air transport pilot license. The air transport pilot license is the one that allows you to fly what are known as heavies, so larger airliners, aircraft carrying 9 or more passengers. The commercial pilot's license enables you to fly a smaller aircraft, but as a job. In Australia and New Zealand, these are lifetime licenses. So once you pass your flying test, the relevant requirements, you get a pilot's license, but you need a medical certificate to be able to use them. And it's the medical certificate that has to be renewed on a regular basis, on a prescribed basis.
So how often do these licenses renew, Michael, and how often do they require medical clearance, and who can do this?
So the medical certificates are called Class 1 medical certificates when they're required for commercial pilots, and they're valid for a whole year up till age 40. From age 40 and older, the certificate is valid for only 6 months for those pilots that are flying by themselves, so single pilot operations. And those would be the sorts of things where you're flying a small helicopter, or maybe you're flying an agricultural operation. But it's 12 months for people who are flying in a multi-crew operation. That's often with two pilots. So those would be airline pilots, and their medical certificates are valid for a whole year. There is a catch in the US. Some pilots are required to do 6 monthly medicals in addition to what's normal here. So it's actually a complex area, but on the whole, medicals need to be redone every year, or for some people every 6 months. Note too that there's also a Class 3 medical certificate, which is for air traffic controllers. Just occasionally, you may come across an air traffic controller who comes to see you. They're bound by the same rules as commercial pilots.
And Michael, as far as medical clearance, who is able to do the clearance?
Right, and that's a term which is often used and probably just needs unraveling a little bit. Probably the first question is, well, who can do those special Civil Aviation Authority examinations, or in Australia, Civil Aviation Safety Authority examinations? The doctors in New Zealand who can do them are called Aviation Medical Examiners, and they are actually delegates of the director of the Civil Aviation Authority. So you need a special legal delegation to be able to do that. And in New Zealand, that requires a doctor to have special training in aerospace medicine. That may be by the Otago University program, or by one of the few other international recognized programs. All aviation medical examiners in New Zealand are listed on the CAA website. And so anybody can go and look up where a nearby examiner is based.
So becoming an aviation medical examiner, you've mentioned that you need to complete a course. What sort of medical background or training do you need to have done? And can a nurse practitioner do this training and become a medical examiner?
Well, again, that's a very topical question. The answer to the question is no, not for commercial pilot medicals, for the class one medicals. There is a requirement that as a minimum, people have done a couple of papers at Otago in aviation medicine and aviation physiology to give people a basic grounding. But many people will go on and do a full master's in aviation medicine to gain adequate background. And as a part of that training, it also has quite a practical bent to it as well. So people get some personal experience of what it means to fly an aircraft, to be addressing the issues of sick patients being transferred, air ambulance work. There's a whole range of additional concepts and competencies which are covered off in that as well. So there is quite an extensive training in New Zealand. New Zealand is unusual in that sense. In many countries, there is a lower degree of training. But that's because in New Zealand, the medical examiner is charged with actually doing the assessment and issuing the medical certificate. In Australia, for example, the vast majority of certificates, and certainly commercial medical certificates, are issued centrally by the regulator. The doctors will gather the information, the regulators will issue the certificate. In New Zealand, the medical examiner is usually responsible for issuing the certificate. And obviously with that, there's quite a significant overhead of expertise needed to perform a risk assessment and perform that duty to an acceptable standard. So becoming an aviation examiner takes a few years of training. I think the best entry into that role is ideally a generalist role, remembering that pilots get all sorts of illnesses. Sometimes a cardiologist might say, well, I want to become a medical examiner, which is fine, but they need to recognize that there are many other conditions apart from heart conditions which are highly relevant in the aviation role. So the general practitioners are particularly well placed for this. We sometimes see emergency medical doctors performing this role, but I think general practice is a good start.
Great. Thank you for clarifying that. So we have a pilot who comes to see us and they're unwell. What is the expectation of the GP with an unwell patient? What do we need to do?
So New Zealand is different to every other country in the world apart from Canada in this respect. It's different because in the Civil Aviation Act, there is an obligation on all medical practitioners in New Zealand to notify the CAA if there's a concern that the pilot has got a medical condition which might interfere with their flying. In most countries, there's a public duty of care expectation that a doctor would notify the regulator if they had concerns about a pilot. But in New Zealand, it's not just an expectation. It is a duty. There's what's called mandatory reporting. So a medical practitioner must, and it says as soon as practicable, let the CAA know if they've got a pilot who has got a condition which is likely to affect the ability of that pilot to fly. This is a weighty obligation. And most doctors, I think it's fair to say, have no idea that it exists, but it does, and it's in law. So the next question that immediately follows on from that. So my patient is my patient and this is private information. How can I go telling the regulator about their medical condition? So it's important to recognize that there is specific indemnification in the Civil Aviation Act to any medical practitioner when they are notifying the Civil Aviation Authority in good faith about a particular medical condition.
So we notify the CAA and then the clearance for our pilot that goes back to the aviation medical examiner, is that correct?
So the process would be that a general practitioner would notify the CAA and the ongoing management of that particular condition would indeed be taken up by the person's aviation medical examiner. Now, ideally, and in law, the pilot is already expected to have had a conversation with their medical examiner so they know what they should be doing about this. I think it's often a challenge to know, well, is this relevant to someone flying? And experience says that often doctors are not sure about whether a condition has got a particular implication for flying. So I would really encourage people at a very early stage to ask for help. I think phoning a friend is an enormous help in these sort of situations. And I would always encourage folk to have some idea who the local aviation medical examiners are. As I say, they're mentioned in the CAA website. Just having a phone call or someone that you can go to and say, look, this pilot's just had a, you know, hernia done. Am I supposed to do something about it? Hopefully the pilot already has, but it's good to have someone who's very familiar with this and can quickly tell you what the implications are. And sometimes the concerns will be significantly more serious. And again, having somebody you can talk it through with is very important.
Thinking about specific conditions, perhaps for a moment, Michael, what things should we be aware of that may affect a pilot's ability to fly?
We consider in aviation something specific, which is usually termed incapacitation, and the risk of incapacitation. In Australia and New Zealand, the way in which this is addressed is by looking at doing a risk assessment on different medical conditions. And there are different sorts of incapacitation. There's the partial incapacitation where, say, an arm doesn't work. That's usually pretty obvious. There would be total incapacitation where someone faints or passes out. Again, that's usually pretty obvious. The thing that is of considerable safety concern is what's called subtle incapacitation, where a pilot's performance is slowly deteriorating and may not be immediately obvious. Now, there are actually procedures, cockpit procedures, which expressly aim to address this. And some of you will be familiar with the process of cross-checking information in the cockpit, where one pilot will state something and the other pilot has to read back what has just been stated and confirm that that's correct. And that process happens extensively in the cockpit. If the readback is not within an appropriate time or is inaccurate, there are processes for double and triple checking that. But subtle incapacitation can occur and is particularly dangerous because it's not immediately obvious. So the approach to, is my patient able to fly, is very much related to determination of those risks. And so we're talking in aviation medicine much more about performance than pathology. So when considering whether the pilot can fly or not, there are a few sort of things that you practically need to think about. Firstly, can you clear someone back to fly? The answer is no, only if you're an aviation medical examiner with the relevant delegation. So don't be tempted to try and do that. And as a word of medico-legal advice, do not ever write in a letter that this pilot is fit to fly or is cleared back to flying unless you have that delegation. Not only does it put you at legal jeopardy because you're not delegated to do that, but also it causes immense upset with pilots when they come in and say, Dr. So-and-so says I can fly, but I can't. And that's a real trap for the unwary. Where GPs can be immensely helpful is providing information and clinical opinion about the condition. It's the information about the condition, not about whether someone can fly. It's an important distinction. So when we're looking at that, providing that information, there's a couple of other things that are worthwhile just bearing in mind. Is the complete medical record available to you if you're writing an opinion about someone's condition? Or have they come in to see you and you've never seen them before? You haven't got a record and you're not at all familiar with them. Experience says that if that happens, beware, because there's often a reason why you've never seen them before. So it is entirely appropriate to check whether you have got reliable records. I remember being taught that 90% of your diagnosis is in your history, and the absence of history is crucial, particularly for some more serious medical conditions. So are there medical standards that this assessment of performance is referring to? And the answer is yes, and they're international standards agreed by a branch of the United Nations called ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization. They're international standards, and New Zealand and Australia are signatories to those standards, and they reflect what sort of eyesight's expected, what sort of hearing's required, and a whole range of topics. What's perhaps important to recognize is that the leading causes of fatal aircraft accidents, and they're incredibly uncommon. You know, you're more likely to die falling down the stairs or getting run over crossing the road. But for the few occasions where large aircraft crash, the leading causes of those crashes are mental health issues and substance use, alcohol and other drugs. Those are particularly relevant topics when you're talking about pilot and piloting safety. So ICAO provides standards around those different conditions, and that's not something that a general practitioner is expected to know, but it's good just to know that there are some standards and that's what will be guiding whether a pilot is able to resume flying or not. There are three questions that are asked about each of those conditions, whatever the condition might be. There are three questions, and I think this is a useful tripod to have in mind when you're considering the risks actually associated with anybody, any patient who's in a safety-sensitive role. What's the risk of the individual condition? What's the risk of the treatment for that condition? And is the patient stable? Those three questions are very helpful. And the third question, the stability, is something which as clinicians in other roles, we very rarely consider. I would quite routinely be seeing a patient, provide my opinion and have a conversation and say, look, do you want to pop back in a week or so and tell me how things are going? Clearly, in aviation, it's not acceptable to say to the pilot mind popping in a week's time and telling me if it's been going well or not, because the passengers might not be totally chuffed about that. The risk and the demonstration of stability is an important component of that assessment which a medical examiner has to do. There's one other question which is also particularly useful for the general practitioner to be aware of if providing an opinion to a medical examiner or the CAA, and it's the question about what sort of surveillance might be necessary for an individual. And typically that might be maybe a pilot's had some melanomas removed, complete excision, they were superficial, there's no concern about the spread, but clearly they've got some sun-damaged skin. What would be the recommended surveillance? The same question might be asked of somebody who's had a myocardial infarction and is on follow-up by a cardiologist. What would be the recommended surveillance? The information about that can be placed in an opinion letter provided to the medical examiner. Then that can be reflected in the way that the medical certificate is drafted. It means that it's informed and it's very relevant to that individual's ongoing care. So thinking about stability, thinking about what surveillance is very helpful information to provide about a patient who's a pilot. But bear in mind that the word of clearance to fly is something that should only be issued by a delegated medical examiner. There's a bit to that, but I hope that gives a bit of a framework to think about these conditions and how to handle them in pilots.
Yeah, that was excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much, Michael. So let's just talk about our pilot who's off on vacation. So we've got a 30-year-old commercial airline pilot who's off on vacation. She's off to the Maldives and she's requesting sleeping tablets for sleep. And whilst away, she's going to be diving every day, starting work the day after her return from holiday. Are there any issues raised by her plans and what recommendations would we, her primary care provider, make in this scenario?
This is not an uncommon scenario as far as young pilots are concerned. Quite a lot of pilots enjoy their scuba diving. There's just some practical questions about how one joins together the responsibilities of flying and also the issue of going diving. PADI and all the different diving organizations provide advice about flying and diving and the risks of associated decompression illness. For most people's purposes in shallow water, so down to 18 meters, 24 hours is ample for the time between completing a dive and flying somewhere. It becomes more complex with repeated dives or deep dives, in which case it'd be advisable for the individual to actually just check exactly what the timing should be. And the relevant diving organizations do have clear advice about that and ensuring the risk of decompression sickness is low. One needs to consider things like what are the stresses for going significantly around the world flying. And we mentioned things like time zone changes, fatigue, venous thromboembolism, medication and flying. These are actually all topics about which most pilots have got quite a lot of experience. So commercial pilots are usually fairly familiar with most of this. One question, however, what about prescribing a pilot sleeping tablets? So pilots can use sleeping tablets, but they have to use it in what's known as an aviation approved manner. Typically, you shouldn't be taking a hypnotic within 12 hours of starting flying. I have to say that it does vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So on the whole, you want to make sure that the pilot has checked what is locally permitted for use of a short-acting hypnotic. And so for that purpose, you wouldn't be using things like diazepam. If people are on long-acting benzodiazepines, then that raises a whole separate series of questions. So short-acting hypnotics are permitted for use in an aviation-approved manner. And I think the third thing that I would also just advise them is to make sure that they've checked on the local issues as far as infectious disease is concerned. Are they up to date with their vaccinations? And are they taking appropriate health precautions, sexual health precautions, contaminated water, the range of travel illnesses which need to be considered if somebody is traveling? There are some useful sources of information about all of these matters. The Professional Associating of Association Diving Instructors, they provide details about diving and flying. There's also the CDC Yellow Book, and for New Zealanders, the Safe Travel website on the New Zealand government website.
Excellent. Thank you, Michael. Our next patient is a commercial pilot with some social concerns that has been raised by his wife when she visited for a routine appointment. He's under pressure at work. He's just moved to a new fleet of aircraft and is now flying long haul. They've just moved into a new house with a significant mortgage. He's not been sleeping well. He's irritable and short of the children. Just before leaving on a seven-day trip, Chris was pulled over by the police and failed a breath test. She's also noticed that he's taking sleeping tablets on a nightly basis and his alcohol consumption has increased. So we decide to invite him in for an appointment and screen for hazardous behaviours. Towards the end of the appointment, we have some serious concerns over his drinking and medication use. So what are our responsibilities as his primary care provider and what do we do now?
I think if it was me, I would be saying, help, what do I do next? Because invariably this will be the end of a long conversation or consultation anyway. And by the way, whilst I'm here, doctor, and they finally pluck up courage to tell you about this particular concern. As I have already mentioned, substance use, alcohol and other drugs, and mental health are high on the list of safety concerns in aviation. This is a real concern. It's not in any sense imaginary. So it is something that there is a need to act on. So I suppose the first question I would ask is, well, what can I do next? Is there anyone who can offer advice? Is there anybody who I can talk to, maybe to Chris or about his work? And what about his privacy and such a highly sensitive matter? And so we maybe pick that apart just a little bit here. So is there anyone who can offer advice? And if so, who? I think medical defense organizations are immensely helpful in this regard. And I think this would be a situation where I would have a low threshold for asking for advice from the medical defense organization. I would like to know what the number is to call at the Civil Aviation Authority if I had to do that. And I'm sure for all of us, there's a sort of bit of a gulp moment. We think, do we really have to, you know, am I imagining it? Am I making this up? Or do I really need to do something? So there is an 0508 number at the Civil Aviation Authority. It's 0508 for safety, which one can call and notify the CAA that you have a significant safety concern. As already mentioned, given that you've got some secondhand evidence, but some clear evidence of a potential safety concern, you're indemnified from any charges for breach of privacy in this situation. The third source of help might be the airline. Again, there's the challenge of who do we call. As far as Air New Zealand is concerned, Air New Zealand has got a large medical department, and we will certainly work with GPs in all sorts of issues that, you know, affect pilots' health and well-being. So that's an option. But, you know, in your time, have you got time to try and find their phone number and find out who to talk? And I can understand that that's sometimes a hassle. The fourth option, which I personally think is a good one, is actually to suss out who your local AME is. Try and find out or introduce yourself to a local medical examiner. As I say, their phone numbers and addresses are listed on the CAA website. and they will be well versed in how you handle these sorts of situations. And it just makes all the difference being able to call somebody for whom this is familiar. And it's not new territory, it's something that they will be familiar with and will be able to do whatever needs to be done. So those would be my first, I think, the medical defense organization, calling the CAA, calling the airline, talking to a local AME are all good options, and the local AME would be high on my list. Having done that, well, sort of, so what? What about Chris? What about his work? Well, if it turns out that he is actually piloting a wide-body aircraft with 300 passengers on board tonight, and he has recently had a failed breath test, and you've got a whole series of concerns about how things are with him, alarm bells ring, and it's important that he has not just a sort of, I suppose, the legal intervention to say, look, we've got concerns, but also the well-being and health intervention to make sure that actually he's looked after through this, because this is going to be a challenging situation, whatever. In New Zealand, there are some significant and important channels for support. I suppose the first question is, well, do you know this individual in person? Do you know him well enough that you can pick up the phone and say, look, I've got some concerns, or can we have a chat? If you can talk to the individual, that is obviously the primary and the best way to be able to find out what the story really is and to offer some practical support. With that is some appropriate support and treatment, and there are various sources of that. One is what's called PAN, Pilot Assistance Network. That's a national aviation network of pilots who volunteer by supporting other pilots when they're going through crises. Sometimes it's bereavement, sometimes it's family, big family issues, sometimes it's professional issues at work, whatever. They provide an arm's length to the regulator, an arm's length to the employer, peer support to individuals when needed. There is also a program called HIMS, H-I-M-S, which is an American euphemism, but the program essentially provides peer support for alcohol and other drug matters in pilots. It's actually the most successful rehabilitation support program internationally, with over 80% of pilots who have gone through their program in recovery. It's available in New Zealand, it's available in Australia, and HIMS will be happy to provide a mentor to pilots who've got substance use problems and support them into recovery and getting appropriate treatment through their recovery. The other option, which is available in many large employers and certainly available in New Zealand, is the Employee Assistance Program, EAP, which is not pilot specific, but it's certainly somewhere that pilots can go immediately to get some support and some practical guidance if they're facing some difficulties at work. Again, that is private. It's not information that is forwarded to anybody else. Those supports are available, and those would be on top of whatever community supports or primary care supports are immediately available in the location that this pilot happens to be working. There's a whole range of issues there. I think being able to contact the pilot themselves is clearly highly desirable, but presents challenges in terms of how you manage the family dynamic there as well, when you've got significant family concern and evidently family stresses that are there. The final thing, which I've just touched upon, is, well, what about Chris's privacy in a highly sensitive matter? I think we've made the point that there is indemnification, but it still is relevant to, I think, cover that off with the person themselves, that we pass on information only if it's strictly necessary. We don't pass it on as a default. Pilots will understandably be very wary of information being passed elsewhere. So that I think it's good to have that conversation up front. As the medical unit in a private company, we are very fastidious about maintaining individuals' privacy. And people come and tell us everything and anything, and that's why we're there. And it's essential that that is able to continue. Pilots are aware already that there is an obligation for them to pass information to the doctors at the Civil Aviation Authority. But again, that has to be handled appropriately and confidentially so that it's not public information. One sometimes has to really cover that off, because I think it's not unreasonable that people are uneasy about it. So it's a complicated case, many things going on. There is certainly help available and avenues for advice available to the medical practitioner, as I've outlined. There's also avenues for advice to the pilot themselves, which I've also outlined.
Our last pilot that I'd quite like to discuss is when a pilot's found to have raised blood pressure at their aviation medical and they come to see you saying they've always had white coat hypertension, they're unhappy with the medical examiner and he doesn't want to stop flying. What can we do here apart from support our patient?
Elevated blood pressure when pilots come to see me is not totally unknown. I usually tell them that it's either due to the excitement of coming to see me as a medical examiner or abject terror, and possibly the latter shows insight. It's a real concern, and I think one has to use some common sense as a medical examiner about that. People's blood pressure is often appropriately up. The question is it usually elevated? I just mentioned here one of the issues around blood pressure in pilots is that the ICAO, so the international regulations, which are 50 years old, have got a specific blood pressure limit of 150 over 90. And if a pilot has blood pressure in excess of that, then they are considered not to meet the regulatory standard. Clearly, this is unrealistic on a whole load of levels. And nevertheless, it's the law, so we have to work with it. What we're really interested in knowing is whether or not a pilot has got consistently elevated blood pressure. And really, we have a primary concern for patient welfare. So as a GP, if a medical examiner sends a pilot along to you to look at their blood pressure because it's been found to be elevated, well, your primary responsibility remains for the welfare of that of your patient. You want to confirm or not the diagnosis and institute or not the treatment. Is this truly white coat hypertension? What are the cardiovascular risks for this particular individual? You need to get the clinical background sorted. And once you've done that, then the second question is, well, okay, so how's this going to affect the piloting? Pilots usually reverse that. They say, well, how's this going to affect my piloting? I'm not fussed about my health and well-being. As doctors, we have an underlying concern, which we shouldn't jettison just for the sake of the moment. And to be honest, managing blood pressure these days with such excellent medications is not a major in terms of a pilot's continued livelihood. I have to say it's sometimes an issue in terms of the past story of this particular pilot who has been well all his life. He's never taken tablets and doesn't propose to start now. Sometimes there's a sort of self-image thing which comes into play here. And that's why there may be some resistance to treatment. There may be some frustration or anger about it all. And that sometimes just needs talking about and talking through if we're going to see somebody who's adherent to the advice that's given to them. So we confirm the diagnosis, we institute treatment. Are there any treatments that are better than others? And again, this is something you may want to talk to the local medical examiner about if you've got any particular questions. Remember, we also talked about that tripod of we need to consider the risk of the condition, we need to consider the risk of the treatment, and we need to consider its stability. So in terms of the condition, well, we've identified it as hypertension. We want to provide a treatment, and ideally we want to provide a treatment which has got minimal side effects or arrhythmically significant side effects. Clearly, we must exclude an acute allergy, but we also need to make sure that they haven't got any other side effects such as cough or particularly postural hypertension. Is there any cognitive impairment? And sometimes things like alpha and beta blockers have got quite a poor side effect profile. So there are some certainly side effects which are pertinent here. If you've got somebody who's doing aerobatics, for example, some of the older agents cause postural hypertension and would not be ideal. A pilot must report that change in medical condition. The change in medical condition is not just the hypertension, it's also the fact that they've commenced some treatment. And ideally, a brief report will be required from the treating doctor, basically saying the diagnosis, what treatment has been instigated, and the fact that there are no side effects, for example, postural hypotension. And a ground trial is usually required of between 1 to 2 weeks before they're allowed to go back flying again. And typically what most pilots do is just to say, I'll wait till I've got a few days off and then I'll start. That's practically how it's managed.
Fantastic. Thank you for your time today, Michael. Just to conclude our podcast now, your take-home messages, please.
I think as far as take-home messages, don't be tempted to tell a commercial pilot that they're fit to fly or cleared to fly unless you have a CAA delegation. Remember, you provide an opinion about the condition, not the flying. Help and advice is available. I think I mentioned earlier on that mental health issues and substance use present the greatest safety risk, and those are areas where medical examiners will be keen to liaise with general practitioners. And finally, the Australasian aviation industry has got a well-developed support structure. Pilots are not alone, and there is help to support them through their career. So that, again, is something that if you have a pilot who's in difficulties, well worthwhile reaching out to a medical examiner, or if they're an Air New Zealand employee, to Air New Zealand.
Thank you, Michael. It's been wonderful having you with us today. If you're a New Zealand GP and would like to claim CPD points, our podcasts are eligible, so please log them. You'll also find a list of resources that Michael has mentioned on our website, goodfellowunit.org. Thanks for listening.